In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'm speaking today with English guitarist Daryl Higham, who, in addition to his solo work, has played lead guitar in the Imelda May Band, done session work with artists like Chrissie Hynde and Jeff Beck. And what brings him to our attention today is his work with our very own Slim Jim Phantom. The pair played together in The Catman, and Daryl is on Slim's latest solo single, a version of the Eddie Cochran tune, Skinny Jim. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Daryl Higham on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Well, I know a guy on bone skin. Everybody's raving about him. Skinny Jim, Skinny Jim. Hey, Skinny Jim. Oh, yes, 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 all the guys love him. Skinny Jim. Well, I went to a party. Skinny Jim, my baby came at me, but she left me. Skinny Jim, yeah, Skinny Jim. Oh yes, 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 I'm a gal of Skinny Jim.
Mighty Manfred here, and my guest for today's Coolest Conversations is famed English guitarist Daryl Higham. In addition to pursuing his own career, he played lead guitar in the Imelda May Band and has done session work with the likes of artists like Chrissie Hynde and Jeff Beck. He also plays with our very own Slim Jim Phantom in The Catman, and it's with Jim that he's paired on Jim's new solo single, Skinny Jim, a version of the Eddie Cochran tune. How are you, Daryl?
Oh, it's great. Great to be here, Manfred. Thanks for talking to me.
Well, thanks for joining me. Now, where in the UK are you from?
Well, I've lived for many, many, many years in London, but then I moved down to a place called Basingstoke with Imelda when we were married. And that's where Imelda still lives with our daughter. And then I moved a little bit further south, down near Portsmouth, a place called Portsmouth, very famous naval port here in the UK.
What drew you to Portsmouth?
Well, it was just, I really liked the idea of living by the coast, if I'm honest with you. And I mean, I wish I didn't, because the rain down here is quite unbelievable. I've never seen rain like it, but it's a beautiful part of the country.
Well, were you playing guitar before you got into rockabilly music?
Oh, no. In fact, I first heard rockabilly music when I was a very young boy in the mid-70s, even before Elvis died. I heard Elvis's music when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I was born in 1970, so I heard Elvis when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and then not long after I heard Eddie Cochran's music for the first time. So I was a big fan long before I started playing the guitar. I guess I was about 12 when I first started playing the guitar, something like that.
How did you come to Elvis or Eddie Cochran? Was this something on the radio, or were your parents playing these records?
No, it was quite strange. It was a very, very hot summer's day, and I was walking down the road with my mother, and our neighbor was playing Elvis music at full blast with the windows open. And it just stopped me in my tracks, and I just said to Mum, "What is that music? Who is that?" And she said, "Well, that's Elvis Presley." I'd never heard of Elvis Presley. I was 4 or 5 years old. And she said, "Come on, come off the street. I've got some Elvis albums at home." So we went into the house, and she got these two Elvis albums from her collection. And these two Elvis albums had all his hits from the 1950s on them. So it was just all his 1950s songs. It wasn't any of his 60s or at that time, contemporary songs, 70s songs. So it was all the Hound Dog and Heartbreak Hotel, Jailhouse Rock, and all the great stuff. And that was it. From that moment onwards, I was a massive Elvis fan and absolutely distraught when he died a couple of years later, because I was already a massive fan. But then I'd already heard Eddie Cochran prior to Elvis dying, because Mum had an Eddie Cochran album, and that really put me on the path to where I am today, if I'm honest with you, because that album had such a profound effect on me that I grew up wanting to be Eddie Cochran, and all these years later, I still want to be Eddie Cochran, really, you know.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I saw that you had portrayed Eddie Cochran, I guess, on stage, and I want to ask you about that in a moment, but still, so did you say a moment ago something about starting to play guitar around the age of 12?
Yeah, I think I'd always been interested in the guitar. I'd wanted to learn somewhere down the line, but the first attempt was a disaster, because my dad bought me a Spanish acoustic guitar when I was about 7 or 8, and all I did was I got a felt tip pen and I tried to make it look like a Gretsch, and then I just stood in front of the mirror and mimed to Eddie Cochran records, you know, so I didn't really do very well with that. But then few years later, I saved up some money and I bought my first electric guitar off my best friend Joe Chapman, and he taught me a few chords, and I just went from there, you know. Very early 80s.
When you were in school then, were you forming bands with any of your schoolmates or?
Yes, we did, funnily enough. We did have a band with a bunch of guys that were my age at the time. We were early teens, you know, sort of 13, 14 years old. And it was mainly punk music. I didn't know much about punk music. I'd kind of missed the first wave of it in the 70s. But I joined this band, and we ended up just playing punk versions of 50s rock and roll songs. So I kind of knew what I was doing, you know. But that's where it all kind of started, yeah.
Were you unusual amongst your friends and your school for your love of rockabilly music and these 50s artists?
No, because, you know, there was a huge 50s revival throughout the entirety of the 70s in the UK. I mean, we were very influenced by America, of course, because we were influenced by so many films and TV programs that were so popular back then. I mean, American Graffiti in the early 70s was a big influence to many people over here. And then we had things like Happy Days, you know, with the Fonz, right, and the Buddy Holly story, and of course when Elvis died in 77, it really kicked off a huge interest in early Elvis, not the Elvis that unfortunately died, you know, at that time, because by then I think a lot of people were not really that terribly interested in the music that he was recording at that period, but people wanted to discover the young Elvis, the cool Elvis, you know. And that really sparked a huge revival in 50s music and fashion here in the UK during that period. And it lasted well into sort of like the mid 80s, really, you know. So I wasn't terribly unusual. I was very young amongst my friends' sort of age group. They were all, you know, 5-6 years older than me. They were all older teenagers and they could all drive, and they used to take me to the rockabilly clubs and things like that. So I was very young to be going out at that time, but I just went out and I loved the music so much. It was an absolute passion of mine. And of course I wanted to play the guitar and I wanted to get up on stage and I wanted to play Eddie Cochran songs. And that's really that was my motivation to start with. And it just carried on from there.
So I know during this period of time, this revival, there were a lot of you know, first generation rockabilly artists that were still alive that were contacted and they wound up going to Europe and playing. What are those first generation rockabilly artists that you've seen impressed you the most?
Well, the very first first generation rockabilly artist I saw live was Ray Campy. Mm-hmm. And he was playing in a club very close to where I grew up, and I was about, I don't know, 14, 15 years old at the time. And I remember when he came on stage and I looked at him and thought, wow, he's so old, you know. And yeah, he was probably younger than I am now, you know. So I remember being shocked at how old he was, but I'd already heard his music and I loved his music, so I was a big fan of his. And then as time went on, I got to see artists like Hayden Thompson, who was signed to Sun Records and made so many great rockabilly records. And then later on, I mean, I started getting into bands in my teens. So I started backing artists like Terry Nolan, Merrill E. Moore, the fabulous piano player. Terry Nolan was a big friend of Buddy Holly and recorded at Norman Petty Studios where Buddy Holly recorded. And then Billy Lee Riley and, oh, just so many. You know, I can't remember them all, but I worked with so many of the first generation rockabilly artists. It, always a great honor, you know.
Did you ever work with Sleepy LaBee for Ronnie Dawson?
No, my band, funnily enough, backed Sleepy LaBeef, but of course he didn't need a guitar player, so I didn't join in on that one. Yeah. But I remember seeing Ronnie play in London in the must have been the early, maybe late 80s or early 90s, and I mean he was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal.
Right. Well, it's interesting to me that you cover the Eddie Cochran tune with Slim Jim at Skinny Jim, because you know, you've got this, well, now I've learned about this, you know, fascination, especially you've had with Eddie Cochran, and that you actually portrayed Eddie Cochran a number of times. Can you tell us some about that?
Well, I had joined a London West End theatrical production of a show called Elvis the Musical, which first came out in the UK in 78, I believe, not long after Elvis died. And it had three actors portraying Elvis at various stages of his career. So there was a young man called Tim Whitnall playing the young Elvis, a guy called Shakin' Stevens playing the middle Elvis of the late 50s into the 60s, and then a guy called PJ Proby playing the older Elvis, you know. And that was the springboard for Shakin' Stevens' success. You may be aware of his music. I know he never had much success in America, but he was huge here in the UK throughout the 80s. And he was kind of an Elvis guy, you know, he kind of got up on stage and moved like Elvis, sang a bit like Elvis, and his music was very 50s influence. Now, fast forward into 96, and they decided to bring that show back, and I got the job as guitar player. So I was playing the Scotty Moore riffs and, you know, that kind of a thing. But they brought back PJ Proby, and they brought back Tim Whitnall, not Shakin' Stevens, unfortunately, because he was a huge star by then, so they couldn't afford him, I guess. But so that was my introduction to the world of theatre, which was not something I'd ever wanted to do before. And then when that show came to an end, I got a job playing Eddie Cochran in a Buddy Holly musical that was touring the UK, and I did that for, I guess, a couple of tours of that, and it was all throughout the UK. But if I'm honest with you, it didn't really sit well with me. I'm not an actor per se, so I kind of struggled with it. I struggled with the whole concept of trying to be Eddie. I'm too much of a fan. I'm too big a fan of Eddie's to do that, if I'm honest with you. It just didn't sit well with me. So it's something I did. I tried it. It was a sort of a boyhood dream to be on stage and actually be Eddie Cochran, but it didn't really work for me. So it's not something that I carried on with. But what I do and have done for many years is I'm with my band, we go out and we play tribute shows, but we play Eddie's songs the way we want to play them. You know, right. We don't necessarily play them authentically. I don't dress up like him. I don't pretend to be him. We just play his songs, and that works better for me, if I'm honest.
You know, you mentioned PJ Proby before going to the UK, he did a bunch of demos that, you know, he would demo songs that Elvis would wound up recording. Did you have much of a relationship with PJ Proby? Did you speak much with him? Or because he's quite a character, I understand.
Yeah, very eccentric guy, lovely man. I mean, a really lovely man. And I didn't have much to do with him because I played on all the 50s and early 60s Elvis era recordings. So I didn't play on any of the 70s recordings that PJ was singing on. Yeah. So when PJ came onto the stage, I would leave the stage, you know. Yeah. So it was one of those things. I never really got to talk to him. And then towards the end of the run, they replaced him. And because I'd never spoken to him and had wanted to, I went up into his dressing room and I knocked on the door and he answered, and I said, "Well, I'm really sorry to hear you're leaving. I'm a huge fan, and I'd really love to talk to you about the recordings that you made in the 50s under the name of Jet Powers," because he was a rockabilly singer in the 50s.
Yeah.
His name was Jet Powers, and he recorded one of the greatest rockabilly songs of all time called "Go Girl Go," which is just a masterful 2 minutes of mayhem, you know, and I loved that song, and I wanted to talk to him about it and how he recorded it. I knew that he had met Eddie Cochran, and he, you know, obviously he'd met the Burnett brothers and Ricky Nelson and all these guys in the 50s. So I wanted to talk to him about that, and we sat in his dressing room and talked for a good hour. And then of course he left the show. But then a couple of years later, I was very fortunate to be involved with co-writing the first biography on Eddie Cochran's life and career, and I managed to reconnect with PJ, and I went to his flat in London. He was living in an apartment in London, and I spent 2 or 3 hours interviewing him, and that was great. And only just recently, within the last 2 or 3 years, I've reconnected with him again, and so we do talk every now and then, you know.
Well, that is great. Now, did I catch you saying that you co-wrote a biography about Eddie Cochran? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. It came out on Mainstream Publishing here in the UK. It was also released in the States. It was, I think, it came through Billboard Books. If I'm not too sure about that, but I think it was. It came out around about 2000, 2001.
And what is the title?
It's called "Don't Forget Me: The Eddie Cochran Story."
So now, over the years, you've played with Slim Jim and the Catmen, and I was wondering, exactly how did you two guys cross paths? How did you meet?
Well, it must have been mid-2000s. I was playing in a place called Green Bay, Wisconsin.
And, oh, yes, I was just in Green Bay, by the way, this past weekend. So,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful place, beautiful place. And that was at the Oneida Casino. I think I'm pronouncing that right, but... it was at the Oneida Casino, and they had a week-long rockabilly festival. It was absolutely fantastic. It was put together by a guy called Phil Duran, and they had everybody that was still around at that time played. You know, as many first-generation rockabilly artists as they could find, and a host of rockabilly bands from all over the world. And I was very lucky to play there for 3 years in a row. And I think it was on the second year that I met Jim for the first time, because he was hosting a jam session.
Okay.
And I was quite busy that year. I was back in Terry Nolan, Rock LaRue. I was also playing guitar with a band called Johnny Bark, which I worked with a guy called John Lewis, and also my own band, The Enforcers. So I was quite busy that week. But I would go down and watch this jam session with Jim. And then I just thought it'd be really great to get up on stage and say that I'd worked with Jim, you know, because I loved the Stray Cats, always a big fan of the Stray Cats. And Jim has always been a great character, a great artist in his own right. So I was, I just wanted to say that I'd met him and worked with him, you know, even if it was just on a jam session. So I got up and I sang a couple of Eddie Cochran songs. And then after I'd finished, Jim came up to me and he said, you know, I'm thinking about coming over and doing a tour of the UK, would you want to sing and play guitar for me? And I said, absolutely. So that's where it all started. And, you know, all these years later, we still work occasionally together and get on ever so well. You know, he's a great guy. I've got a great deal of time for Jim. He's a wonderful person to be around, a very good person to go and have dinner with, a very interesting guy to talk to. And a great guy to tour with as well. You know, he's got a lovely dry sense of humor, which is very in keeping with perhaps the English humor, you know, so we get on ever so well.
So what got you guys into the studio to cut Skinny Jim? When did he approach you about it?
Well, he came over last year and we did a 6-week tour of the UK and some Europe dates as well. And I just said to, because I have a studio very close to where my daughter lives, in fact, the same village that my daughter and Imelda live at. And I've had that studio since 2005, so I tend to do all my recordings there. So I said to Jim, if you're coming over, well, let's find some time and go in and make another Catmen album. So that's exactly what we did, and Jim wanted to sing a couple of songs on this album, and so we did. We Skinny Jim is the perfect song for him. It could have been written for him, really. So it's the perfect song, and he sang it brilliantly. And I think the other song that he did on the album was Off the Hook by the Rolling Stones. I don't know too much about the Rolling Stones, I've got to be honest with you. It's it sort of comes along after the music I love, you know, but I understand they're a popular band and people like them, you know.
Yeah, apparently so. Apparently so. Yeah. Well, Off the Hook would be an early Stones track. So with Skinny Jim, of course, you know, it's like, oh yeah, is it Slim Jim doing Skinny Jim? But so the song itself credited to Cochran and his manager, songwriter Jerry Capehart. And are there like any aspects to that Cochran Capehart songwriting that really resonates with you? What do you love about Cochran's original songwriting?
He had a very wry sense of humor, Eddie, and that came out in a lot of his lyrics. They were quite funny, quite tongue in cheek. Even what is considered, I guess, one of the first protest songs with Summertime Blues. If you listen to the lyrics, it's quite a funny song. You know, it's not all angst and and anger. It's quite funny, and perhaps, you know, a lot of his songs, I think, contain that humor. But then you've got songs like Dark Lonely Street, which is quite a hard song to sit through. It's not classic Cochran by any stretch of the imagination, but lyrically, you know, it's one of my, well, there's a lot of things to lament when an artist that you love dies so early in their career, because Eddie didn't live long enough to experience that sort of rock historian thing that came along in the 60s, where journalists would talk to musicians about what was going through their head when they wrote songs, you know, because I really wish that Cochran would have been asked questions like that. He didn't live long enough, unfortunately, so we'll never know. But if you listen to a song like Dark Lonely Street, it's quite a, as the title suggests, it's quite a dark song. And he could only have been 17 or 18 years old when he wrote it or co-wrote it. So there's a lot of mysteries there in amongst Eddie's music, because on the one hand you've got almost like Chuck Berry-esque poetry with the lyrics, right, but you've got this wonderful backbeat, powerful rock and roll backbeat, which you could say influenced and still influences to this day musicians. But that whole sort of groove that you get from songs like Something Else, Come On Everybody, Summertime Blues, Nervous Breakdown, you know, that's the blueprint of what rock and roll has morphed into as the years have gone by, and it goes straight back to Eddie Cochran.
So when Jim came over, you guys recorded Skinny Jim and Off the Hook, and the rest of the tracks were for a Catman album or not?
That's right. Yeah, okay. Those two tracks, Off the Hook and Skinny Jim, are going to be on the next, well, they are on the new Catman album, which was released a few weeks back.
Okay, so that is just out. And what is the title of that?
It's called Catmen Are Back.
Well, truth in advertising there.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, but it's good. I mean, you know, with all Catmen albums, we've done three of them now, uh-huh, and there's always a healthy portion of original songs on there as well. So, of course, the easy way out is to just record your favorite rockabilly songs from the 50s, but we like to put in songs that we've written, and we try and make them sound as if they're from the era. We're not too worried about authenticity, but we like to put some production in there as well. But there's some really interesting material on this particular album. We've done a cover of the Julian Lennon song. Oh, I can never remember the title of it. It's such a catchy pop song that came out in the early 80s. It's Just Too Late, or It's Too Late, or something like that. You may know the song, but It's Too Late for Goodbyes. I think that's the song. So we've done a rockabilly version of that, which is really cool. And, you know, it's just a really fun album.
Well, are there any plans to tour on that? Or you guys would just be playing shows primarily in the UK, or do any shows stateside in the future?
It's very difficult to get over to the US these days. You know, the whole problem with visas and so on and so forth. It's very, very difficult. But Jim comes over to the UK a lot over the course of a year, so I'm absolutely certain that we'll do some Catmen shows next year. Yeah.
Oh, cool. So I want us to go out with this title track to I believe it's a 2021 release
that you put out called Heatwave Mama. Speaking of original tunes, is that an original song of yours, or who wrote Heatwave Mama?
It's an original song. Yes, I wrote that a few years back. Yeah.
Any particular inspiration for that one?
Well, it's kind of funny, really, because one of my best pals, his name's Clive Duffin, and he runs Foot Tapping Records, which is the label that I put out all my releases on. And he is always trying to come up with ideas for me in order to record an album. So a couple of years back, of course, you know, musicians weren't doing a lot of work back then because of the lockdowns and the restrictions. So I had a lot of time to record, you know, and so Clive phoned up and said, you should do a summer album, you know, a summer themed album. And he said, you know, don't spend too much time on it. Just kind of Google a load of rockabilly summer songs and record them, and we'll put it out, you know? And I said, well, okay. So I started Googling rockabilly summer songs. I didn't really find that many, if I'm honest with you. So, I ended up having to write a load of songs for it as well. And Heatwave Mama was just a silly fun song that, you know, is more about the groove of the music, really, rather than the lyrics, you know. But it's a fun song. It turned out well, and so I was very pleased with it.
Well, cool. So you mentioned difficulty getting here stateside to play, but have you toured in the US before?
Yes, I mean, I was just thinking the other day that with the amount of touring that I've done in America over the years, it's probably, if I was to put it into like a one period of time, you know, like it would probably be a full year of my life has been spent in America over the years. I mean, the vast majority of that was working with Imelda,
right?
Because we came over and toured America with Jeff Beck, supporting Jeff Beck, and also with the rock and roll dance party DVD that we recorded at the Iridium in New York. We did a lot of work in the States with Jeff, and then with the Imelda tours, we'd come over for a month at a time, you know, and just drive all over the States in a tour bus. So we spent a great deal of time here, but I've been coming to America since my early 20s. I came to live. I lived in America for 6 months in 92 because I worked with Eddie's last road band, the Kelly Four, and I got to meet Eddie's mother and his sister, and absolutely wonderful time, you know. So over the years, you know, I've spent a great deal of time here.
Wow, that's pretty incredible that you were able to meet, you know, members of his family. And where were you living in the U.S. at the time?
I was in a place called Anderson in Missouri, and it was right down in what they call the tri-state area, I think, where Missouri meets Alabama. Was it Alabama?
Arkansas, you mean?
Arkansas, yeah, okay. and another state. I can't remember what it is. My geography is appalling. I do apologize, but
it's quite all right. So you yeah. spent some time in Memphis over the years.
I did go to Memphis. I went there in 92. There was a 15th anniversary Elvis tribute show at the Memphis Convention Center, and you had Carl Perkins was headlining. There was Ronnie McDowell, and Scotty Moore was playing guitar for Ronnie McDowell. There was the Jordanaires. James Burton was playing at it. It was an incredible event, and I managed to get in backstage somehow, and there was a young English guy that was kind of opening the show, and everyone thought that I was that young English guy. So I was given access to everything, you know. So I was just kind of wandering around shaking hands with the Jordanaires and James Burton and talking to people, you know.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Well, that's so that like, really, now that's, you know, of course, way before cell phones or cameras on phones. But were you able to get any pictures?
I did get some photographs. Yeah, I got some photographs of me with Carl Perkins and Scotty Moore and James Burton, the Jordanaires. I mean, I pretty much shook hands with everybody that was there, you know. I think DJ Fontana was there, who was Elvis's first drummer.
Yeah.
It was a who's who of the Elvis world, you know. It was quite an incredible
So there's this interesting perspective I'm thinking of here, and that's, you know, you're born like in 70 and you hear Elvis, and then this leads to Eddie Cochran, and you have a fascination with that sound and that and the music of that era. I mean, it's pretty incredible that not only, you know, that you start playing the music, but over the course of your career, you're able to actually meet all these people before they're gone.
Yes, I was very lucky. I mean, I've always had, I've always taken advice wherever I can get it. And I think one of the best bits of advice I ever heard was from, believe it or not, Gene Vincent. I never met him because he died in 71, a year after I was born. But yeah. I remember when I was very young, I bought a Gene Vincent album and it had an interview on there. And on this interview, he's asked this question, what advice do you give to young musicians? And, you know, is it all just down to luck? And Gene says, you know, you make your own luck in this world. You know, if you're good at something, somebody will listen to you. And I thought, that's great advice. So I've always gone out and made my own luck. You know, I don't actually believe in luck, if I'm honest with you. I think you make your own way in life, and the harder you work and the more you put time into what it is you do and get better at it, then people that can help you will gravitate towards you. And I've always believed that. So every time I've been offered an opportunity to do something, I've taken it, and it's worked, you know, pretty well over the years. I mean, it's all personal things, you know, meeting Eddie's family, meeting the Elvis guys. I mean, all the people that I've met and worked with on one level is really kind of a something that I'm proud of as a fan of rockabilly. You know, it's not actually paid the bills as such. It hasn't bought me nice cars or nice houses. It hasn't helped in that respect, but it's ticked a lot of boxes of things that I've always wanted to do that actually meant a great deal to me. It actually means more to me than having the nice houses and the nice cars and things like that, because this is something that I've been into all my life and will stay with me for the rest of my life. It's more important to me than things like that. It's keeping it all alive, I think, now is what drives me on, is because, you know, I can sort of see the end of it, but I don't want it to end whilst I'm still on this planet, you know? So I just want to keep the whole thing going and do my bit, really.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, I appreciate it, Manfred. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a listen now to the title track to your 2021 album, Heat Wave Mama, right here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Well, my girl is hot as a blazing sun. No matter what she does, it's as good as done. I wear sunglasses when she walks in the room. A heat wave mama, she can burn the moon.
I'm here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, a portion of his tune Heatwave Mama, and that's the title track to his 2021 album. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Daryl for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. We've got a very special Coolest Conversations lined up for next time. Van Morrison has got a new album. It's called Accentuate the Positive, and he'll join us to tell us all about it. Your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.